Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the second series of our year's lectures. We've got a nice, clear evening this evening, unlike some of the ones we had towards the end of the first run. My name is John Madden, as many of you know. I'm the president this year of the Vancouver Institute. I would like to say with how relieved I am that the designated president for next year has returned from his peregrinations, having retired for about the umpteenth time and gone to a whole bunch of places, has come back. Eric Vogt has been president before of this organization, and we're looking forward to him taking it on again next year. All of you also know that one of the challenges of being president of this institute is to try and entertainingly cajole those of you who are not yet members to join the institute at the incredible bargain that we offer for this series of lectures. And you can, some of you who are unfamiliar with the institute will know that there is a, or will find that there are pamphlets looking like this out on the front desk. There you'll see that students can get a whole year's membership for only $5, single memberships 15, and families 25. Now, I was all prepared coming here, having had the nice long break, and you also know that I also like to compare the entertainment that we afford and the relative price to the entertainment that the Grizzlies afford. And I was going to say, well, of course, there you only, you know, you go, you pay $50 or $60 and all you see are losers, and we have nothing but winners. However, they've won a few games, I understand, since then. But it's still true, I think, that we have an unmatched string of winners in terms of our speakers. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I would just like to note for you that next Saturday, Professor Robert Evans will be addressing us on the title Healthy, Wealthy, and Cunning: Profit and Loss from Healthcare Reform. Those of you who don't know Bob, I think will be very agreeably surprised. He's probably about the funniest economist that I know. I think you'll find him a very entertaining and a very thoughtful speaker at the same time. And just by the way, on February the 10th, you'll want to be here for Madame Lysiane Gagnon, the political columnist at both La Presse and the Globe and Mail, who will be speaking to you on a subject which I'm sure you'll guess, to do with the between two referendums, the future of Quebec and Canada. Dr. Fraser Mustard was kind enough to tell me before we started about the best introduction he'd ever had. So I, of course, waited, and he told me that the best introduction he'd had was the chairperson of a meeting somewhere up in Northern Ontario, who, having looked at his very impressive and extensive resume, simply stood up and said, "Well, I can see you had the correct upbringing in early childhood." When you listen to Fraser, if the real import of that remark is not clear to you, I'm sure it will be by the end of this evening. About four times a year, I guess, probably like many of you, when I return exhausted from a day's work, instead of going to bed, which I should do, I sit in front of the television and find myself watching television to all hours of the night. About 3 weeks ago, I was in one of these modes and found myself watching News World in black and white. And there was a fairly handsome-looking young man with a white coat on addressing the TV audience on the relative merits of butter and margarine. And I believe he said, along the course of that, that margarine was almost as dangerous as watching television. I'm not sure quite what he meant by that in light of what we know now. I'd recognize the clipped tones. To be honest, Fraser, I didn't totally recognize your face. There was a little more hair in the place, but the clipped tones were unmistakable, and it was indeed Fraser Mustard. And those of you, I think I was in short pants when the butter margarine debate was going on. Certainly Norman DePoe came on to thank him. And it was black and white television. I mention this really to give you some idea of the span of Fraser's contribution to this country. There is a very abbreviated biography, which I will read, but it doesn't, in my view, give a real impression of the enormous contribution that this man has made, and particularly in the last 12 years. 12 years, is it, Fraser, that he's been working, been heading up the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. However, let me just read then now the brief biography. Fraser was born in Toronto, received his MD from the University of Toronto in 1953, and his PhD from Cambridge University in 1956, just in time for the butter margarine debate. In 1966, after several years on the medical faculty of the University of Toronto, he moved to McMaster University in Hamilton to help establish the new School of Medicine and the Faculty of Health Sciences. After 16 years at McMaster University as a medical scientist and educator, he took on the task of creating and establishing a unique Canadian institution. And I may say it's more than just a unique Canadian. I don't think there's anything like it in the world. Which, namely, the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research. He's now president of the Institute, which is a research network that studies complex problems in the sciences and social sciences. This institution, created in 1982, involves over 200 researchers in institutions in Canada, the United States, Europe, Israel, and Japan. The programs include areas such as cosmology, evolutionary biology, and the determinants of economic growth. The output from these programs has influenced policies in the public and private sectors in such areas as science and technology, economic growth, health, and human development. Dr. Mustard has received numerous honors and awards, including the 1993 Royal Bank Award, and he's a companion of the Order of Canada since 1994. Dr. Mustard will address us tonight on the subject, Prosperity or Decline, Canada's Choice. Fraser.
Thank you, John. The title's a bit pompous, but you should know why I'm prepared to come here and talk about it. And there's a bit of a history that goes behind it. The medical school I went to in Toronto always left you with a bit of dilemma in your early education, because our professor of pathology would tell you that lots of people have the TB bacillus, but only certain people express the disease. And then he'd go through a long list of factors that cause the disease to be expressed, which, in the simplest language, were the social environment in which people lived. Now, he gave that to you, and it haunted you as you went through medical school, because nobody ever came back to that theme again. But then when you went into your first years of practice, you began to see where a lot of your health problems came from. And then you also saw the effectiveness of the therapies you recommended, which were heavily influenced by the environment from which the person came from and where they had to go back to. But being physicians, we were trained that there were magic bullets that cured, and those other problems were not really our responsibility. But it kind of haunted you as you went on through your career. And you realized that somehow or other, the way economies work determine the social environments in which people live and work. Now, you couldn't put it together, but it sort of troubled you. And as I wandered through my role at McMaster, replacing John Evans, and by the way, they had no selection process at McMaster. The president came over and said, "You're going to be the dean." Well, I said, "I didn't ask to be dean." He said, "You're going to be the dean." I thought that's a rather kind of dictatorial university, but perhaps that's the way you should run institutions, to not have selection committees. I'm sure you've got lots of them here in the democracy. Anyhow, I began to puzzle about the fact that I could sense that the country's wealth-creating base, by my sense, and your former dean of arts here called me a physiocrat, and I figured out what that is. Eventually went back and looked it up, those of you who are economists. But I realized that it's going to be tough to finance the public domain in the future, because I could see our wealth base was sliding. In retrospect, 75 was a good year to think about, and I'll show you some information as to why that was. And so when the choice came to create this institute, I said, boy, this would be a good thing to do, because we're moving into a new world in which ideas from science will be hugely important in building a new economy. And our first project, which involves some people from this university, in artificial intelligence, was geared to get in what I'm going to talk about tonight, the chips for neurons revolution, which is an important technological change. But then we found, as we wandered around the country, all kinds of people said, this is unimportant and we're not in a period of major change. Indeed, for reasons which I won't go into tonight, a group of us appeared before the now famous or infamous McDonald Royal Commission on the Economic Future of Canada in the mid-1980s. And it was literally like two ships passing in the dark. We, and John McDonald from McDonald Detweiler is present, and 25 other people, tried to convince the commissioners and the research people, A, we're in a period of profound economic change, and hey, it's a new way to do things. Well, that led me to be pretty frustrated, but this institute is kind of a marvelous instrument. You kind of don't have any Senate to pay any attention to. You've got a research council, which Barry McBride sits on, but we select our research council members so they're compliant, sensible people. Right, Barry? All right, and we said, you know, maybe we should explore whether anybody knows anything about economic growth and science and technology. And so I see the president of Simon Fraser's in the audience. And so I suggested I should meet with Dick Lipsey. And Dick Lipsey, to me, wrote the best-selling classical economic text in the English-speaking language. And I said to the person who advised me, I said, "You mean I got to talk to one of these neoclassical economists?" They said, "Take him to lunch and don't have any economists present." So I took him to lunch and didn't have any economists present. And lo and behold, Dick said, "Hey, this is the toughest problem in economics. Really, what is innovation all about, and how does it determine economic growth?" And I won't take you through all the horrors of trying to make an economist together to tackle this question, but I must say the program that he started, which I'm going to say a little bit about tonight, has been very instructive for me. And for those of you, Craig Riddell at UBC is part of the program in economic growth, Lipsey and Rick Harris. And if they're in the audience, I apologize for what I'm going to say, because this is just a lowly physician looking at what they say and listening to the debate, but recognizing something important, as in health. No one knows a hell of a lot about what determines economic growth. A pretty basic issue. We'll talk a bit about that tonight. And then as you go through all of this, the early childhood story becomes pretty important, because it looks like our basic coping skills are already set in early childhood. And I'll tell you this story now, because it'll give you a setting for why I have become an instant expert with absolutely no experience on early childhood. Through the work of the Population Health Program, Bob Evans and Clyde Hertzman in this institution, we really realized that early childhood sets a huge chunk of the health risks in adult life through some pathways I'll talk a bit about or explore with you, but also determines your capacity to learn. And so I was asked to go to a meeting of universities and community colleges, or their equivalent, in Winnipeg about 2.5 years ago to talk about the learning society, but I made it one condition. I wouldn't talk about what post-secondary education institutions do. I was only going to talk about 0 to 6. And so they put me on first in the program, and I talked about 0 to 6, particularly 0 to 3, the way the cortex of the brain sets up and wires. And of course, the key person who's educated me is one of our fellows in this institution in medicine, Max Sinneter, who's great on how vision develops in the cortex of the brain. And so I gave my little spiel, and I didn't know that there was a reporter for the Globe and Mail sitting in the audience. And so he came up afterwards. Now, this is a reporter in Winnipeg for the Globe and Mail. You've got to understand the world. And so he scribbled it all down, and he sent the story in. And I can tell you, if I'd given the same remarks in Toronto, it would have been ignored, but doing it in Winnipeg was the right place to do it. And the managing editor that night said, hey, this is a good front page story, and he put it on the front page of the Globe and Mail. As I got on the plane out of Winnipeg the next day, and I read this thing, I said, whew, that's interesting. I could never get that kind of story out from within Toronto. But the fascinating thing about it is that that story is probably called the greatest hotline episode in my office. When I got into the office, Dorothy McKinnon was in the office, and she said, what did you say in Winnipeg? The phone's been ringing ever since I got in here. And it's an extraordinary story, because simply giving the linkage between how early childhood affects later events actually captures huge attention. I'm going to say a bit about that tonight, because this whole story then is a story about my experience with the Institute, which I attribute none of my comments necessarily reflect the real academic merits of it. My people in the programs have a better judgment of that. But I'm going to try to do a synthesis for you across these different fields. But I thought that kind of anecdotal story would tell you how I've gotten here, and I will sort of, for those of you who are very academically inclined, don't worry, my 6 children tell me when I sit at a table with them now, too bad you didn't know about this when you were a father, Dad. Well, now, this gadget works. The challenge for tonight is, how did Western societies become rich? How does technological innovation, a powerful growth force in economic growth, and how does living in good social environments improve your health and well-being? Those are sort of the basic themes I talked about. And it's interesting, when I met with some of the Credit Suisse, first Boston people in London several years ago, they had a marvelous chart, which is the title for my talk, Prosperity or Decline. And they argued, essentially as I'm going to argue, that we're in a period of deep and broad technological change, and societies that capture it will prosper, societies that bomb it will decline. And it's a very serious issue, and I'm going to point out why I think it's serious. It's a marvelous document, it's short, it's done by a European financial institution that understands the problem. I've never seen an equivalent paper by any Canadian institution. The second comment is from the man who was recently the head of the American Economics Association, Amartya Sen, who said the best marker of the success of an economy is the equity of the health of the population. Very important thing, which is not usually fitted into our standard economic measures. And the final comment was the man who used to head the London School of Economics, a German, Dahrendorf, a political scientist economist, who wrote a very depressing paper about 8 months ago, in which he said that this period of change, it's not certain that the Western countries will be able to handle it and sustain their social stability and democracy. A very discouraging paper from the man, but I think he's really raising quite a challenge, whether the economic forces that have been unleashed are such that we can cope with them. Now, I think we have enough knowledge to do that, and that's my thesis for tonight. So let's begin. This is just a simple presentation of Homo sapiens' existence as a species on the planet, expressed as one calendar year. The reason why I do that is I have trouble thinking in tens of thousands of years, but I can think in a calendar year. So if you think of your existence as a species as 200,000 years in a calendar year, it kind of stands out. And you'll notice that Homo the sap, We chugged along with a population of less than 100 million on the planet until late in December. But the important part in that chart is the first, in my view, major technological change occurs in the middle of November. That's when we learn how to produce more foodstuffs than we can consume through the agricultural revolution, which allows others to do something else. And as the head of our human development program, Dan Keating, says, that's when Homo sapiens began experiments, and I underline the word experiments, with civilization, that is, creating social orders, etc. So if you think about that breakpoint, as one of my colleagues point out, thievery and wars didn't begin until the middle of November, basically, because there weren't things to steal, there were things to fight over. So when you think of our existence in this kind of way, it's relatively recent that we create these social structures and build these economies. Up until that time, we lived in groups of 50 to 100, largely probably controlled by women. And so the rearing of the young was probably reasonably well looked after. Indeed, if you go back into primate life, it is true that many of the troops and other primates tend to be groups of 50 or so, tend to be controlled by matriarchal lines, who are very protective, they can also fight. Indeed, as Bob may tell you, on Saturday night, in the Hall of Baboons at Kenya, Sapolsky, who studied them, cannot dart the females in the troops, because if he does, the females will gang up on them and tear them apart. But he can dart any of the females, the males, the females don't give a damn. Because they're sort of accepted by the females in the troop, but they can discard them and get another one, if you know what I mean. It's an interesting sort of theme in primate evolution. Now, the other part of this story, when you think about it this way, you have a biological inheritance that comes from your primate origins. And that is when you're challenged by something going to get you, you go into the fright and flight syndrome, which Selye described rather well when he was alive in this country. And that's how the cortex of your brain responds to a challenge, let us say of something going to eat you a long time ago in the history. You had to get away from it. And so what you did is you had to put out those chemicals, hormones, largely steroids, that shut down all the rest of the body's systems. And that allows you to mobilize your energy to run faster than the tiger if you're in good enough shape. And I hope you can to get away from it. That syndrome is the same syndrome that the people in science face when Barry McBride snarls at Bill Unruh, who I know is in the audience, and Bill's told me this, that what Barry does to Bill, he creates this fright and flight syndrome. And Bill's steroid levels go up, and he's dysfunctional for several hours, I'm told. But the point is that that basic response is part of our biological ancestry. And so how you cope with a challenge is an extremely important part of the story. So it's all rooted in that slide. The other thing you'll note on that slide is that there are a whole series of interesting technological revolutions that occur until from November until December, which I can't go into tonight, but Lipsy can take you through them if he's not already done it. But late in December, around New Year's Eve, you'll notice that the population, that little green line, explodes. And Homo sapiens is now approaching 6 billion on the planet. And by calendar year expression, that's an enormously rapid change. What went on then to create this huge change in the population on the planet? One of them is the Industrial Revolution and enhanced prosperity, which I'll say a little bit about its effect. And secondly, that affected the health and well-being of populations, which changed mortality rates so people lived a lot longer, which is a very important driving force as to why the population grew. So that compressed history contains a bit of the themes I'm going to talk about, and it shows two major technological changes that had deep and broad effects on society. One is the agricultural revolution, and the other is the industrial revolution. Well, let's look at health in terms of that New Year's Eve story. McEwen, a British physician, beavered away for years trying to figure out why the health of Britain's populations improved as measured by death. And death is always a nice endpoint in health because it's not too controversial. It's kind of absolute. This is from the 1993 lecture by one of the two Nobel Prize winners, Fogel. There's an American economic historian who does a very sophisticated mathematical analysis on historical records. He didn't believe McEwen's conclusion in his work that the health of the British population improved because of improved prosperity and better nutrition. He said that's a lot of nonsense. But he went into the records of Western countries where he could get the records and tracked it down. This simply shows you the crude death rates for France from 1700 to 1993 or so. And you can see they steadily decline. Now, it doesn't take any genius to figure out that medicine could do very little until the mid part of this century. And is it all due to public health, or is it due to broader issues? Well, Fogel tried to unravel that, and the database he has for all the Western countries he tracked shows essentially the same phenomenon. This is not just France-specific. And he did two things when he looked at this. One is he knew that height is a measure of your genetic characteristics and how well you're nourished when you're young. And so he knew that if he took the mean height of a population, and I emphasize the word mean, if the population was not being well enough nourished overall, the mean height would be shorter than what it should be. And so he found that mean height correlated closely with life expectancy. When the mean heights of populations improved, life expectancy improved. Interestingly, in his paper, he also could follow that when economies get into trouble, mean height can go the other way and life expectancy can go the other way. Very interesting set of records over 250 years. The other one is weight, and the thing he was picking on a weight here is a lot of people had enough calories to stay alive but not enough calories to work, which is not a good position because your mortality rates are higher. He didn't concentrate on our problem of having too many calories, but it happens to be a kind of a U-shaped curve if you look at weight. But the real thing I want to concentrate on is picking up on the mean height measurements against agricultural production, distribution, and prosperity, and showing very clearly that one of the powerful effects of the Industrial Revolution, prosperity, better food production and distribution, and dramatic changes in mean height over time, corresponding with a much greater change, or significant change in life expectancy. And the other thing from his conclusion, which is very dramatic, is that he could show from these studies that the chronic diseases of adult life, which are not too dissimilar to what we have today, though they didn't have as many of them because people didn't live to that older age, were actually directly correlated with his data about early childhood. Indeed, he came to the conclusion that early childhood set the bulk of the chronic disease problems in adult life. So Fogel brought out in a much more forceful scientific manner what McEwen had concluded, that the Industrial Revolution prosperity was affecting populations through nutrition. What Fogel said, it's affecting through nutrition, particularly of the young. What Fogel could not measure in those records is the quality of what I'm going to talk about nurturing, because the two turn out to be powerfully important. The other thing in Fogel's argument, which took me a little while to get my colleagues in the economic growth program to buy into, is that Fogel pointed out that the improvement in the quality of the population accounted for at least 50% of the economic growth in the United Kingdom since the Industrial Revolution. So when you're talking about human capital, if I can use that language, the quality of the human capital becomes enormously important. And so if you're trying to think about economies for the future, you have to think about this dynamic. Now, basically what I've told you is essentially what I'm going to talk about for the rest of the night, and if you'd like to go, you can. But I'm going to try to put flesh around what Fogel and McEwen have done and try to understand, see if we can get an understanding of how this dynamic works. Well, Nathan Rosenberg, who is in our program, wrote a book called How the West Grew Rich. And an interesting question to ask people is, how did Western countries become rich? And you get all kinds of answers. About 10% of the audience will answer it by Rosenberg's standards. Rosenberg has two key points in his book. One, the power of technological innovation, and we've already seen some hints of that. And second, institutional innovation. Major technological changes require new institutions. If you can't create new institutions to cope with the technology, you can't make the change. And so what historians have noted, economic historians and others, is that periods of what Dick Lipsey calls deep and broad technological change require very complex, wrenching institutional changes. And you read about it in the newspapers, you see it, some of you may be experiencing it. So to have institutional change, you have to have societies that have the freedom to change, because if they're trapped into rigid structures, they can't change. So you get into that kind of balance in how you structure societies. Taking that theme, then one can argue that in Western societies, we may have seen two sort of New Year's Eve events. One is the first industrial revolution, the harnessing of fossil fuels to replace muscle and water power. And that revolution is important because historically, that's when you break the slavery and serfdom phenomenon, because you don't have to keep people in a constant energy loop. And secondly, it's when democracy begins to emerge in our societies, universal suffrage and women having equal quality of opportunity, because there's a relationship between how you create wealth, as I'm using it, and its distribution that determines the quality of societies and what they can do. The second major change is the turn of the century, and I'm going to say a little bit about it because its records are records that you can at least look at to get some sense of what takes place, was the movement of electricity in to replace steam power. It's a very interesting change, what we know about it. And the third one, labeled the third industrial revolution here, I would argue simply as chips for neurons. It's the creation through technology of low-level intelligence that takes humans out of having to do dull, repetitive tasks. Sometimes called the information highway and all those terms, but I much prefer the term chips for neurons to follow steam power replacing muscle power in the system. So it's a basic change in the property that humans have to do, or do at the moment, that allows new things to take place. Now, if we look at the steam versus electricity story, and this is from Paul David's paper, it's the only one I know of on this, which Dick Lipsey found, you see electricity begins to penetrate as a power source at the turn of the last century, and steam, which is at its peak at the turn of the last century, declines. But if you look at that transition, it's taking a long time. It doesn't occur overnight. It takes a long time. So the trick is here is that these transitions, which change the way you do things, don't occur overnight. This one's at least 40 years, which is ominous. And you only have to think of what a factory was like 150 years ago, driven by steam power, multi-stories and belts and machines all in line, to what happens with electricity, single story, flexible machines and everything else, to know some of the simple changes with it. This is what economists call total factor productivity, and I'm going to come back to it again, therefore I want to bring it in here. You'll notice that total factor productivity in the United States is flat from about 1889 through to about 1920. That means the economy really isn't growing, because it's going through this transition. You're going from one system to another system. And this is rather interesting because of the wage income problems. Clerical wages in constant dollars in the United States declined steadily from around 1890 to 1920. And so when you're going through these transitions, these phenomena can occur. And it's interesting, Fogel talks about it. And Fogel has a funny slide, which I'm not sure how good it is as data. But if you look at mean height in the U.S. population from the record system, the mean height of the United States population keeps improving with JAG, but then it starts to go into a decline, and it goes into a steep decline in his estimates in this period of the transition. I know nothing about the health data because I haven't been able to get at those records, but Fogel does talk about this phenomenon of major technological changes producing profound changes in societies with effects on people. Well, if we understood economic growth, could we handle the problem differently? I think you can, and I'm going to propose that to you tonight. Now, one of the things in setting up the program with Dick Lipsey, we managed to capture Paul Romer before anybody else did, and Paul's claim to fame, I suppose, is he took up the solo argument about determinants of economic growth, the residual that couldn't be explained, and said, hey, this is technological innovation, and he put it into the theoretical framework, and it's caused a great deal of trouble because the implications of that argument put into the theoretical framework of economics has huge effects on how you look at public policy, which I don't want to get into debate tonight because I can't really debate it that well. The skirmish is going on, but the historians say Romer is right, and a fair cadre of his colleagues now say he's right. But the interesting thing from the 1992 essay in The Economist magazine, it pointed out that economists had very little to say about this aspect of economic growth. Business cycles are a totally different subject from the power of technological innovation, changing the way societies create and produce things. This summary is from one of Lipsy's papers. In the terms of economic growth, and I call it prosperity, the neoclassical theory simply couldn't incorporate technological innovation within its theoretical framework. Solow assumed it came in from the heavens and just drifted down and by accident and you used it. Romer's argument is driven by economic forces, social economic forces, therefore you have to put it in the theory. The new growth theory makes technological innovation a key part of understanding economic growth. The real gap in our own program is tying observation, people observe what's gone on like a Solow, in with the theory. There's a huge gap here. Worse, Bill, than in cosmology. At least your theorists are getting closer to observation. But I need to put you and the economists together to see if I can get you to instruct them how they have to tie observation into their theoretical framework. So there's a split there, which is a real tension in our program, but that's a good tension. And the problem is the gap between B and C, until there is solved, is not easy to develop policies for economic growth, because those recommending policies from the standpoint of observation are put down by the theorists. And the theorists are put down by the people from observation, and you can imagine the seesaw that goes on in society. But my simplistic way of putting it together actually comes from an earlier article in The Economist magazine who has an editor who thinks about this subject. I've got wealth creation on the vertical axis and time along the horizontal scale. And a standard sort of economy is going along in that white line. It's continuing to grow as things change and has business cycles. But if you accept the arguments that come from the new concepts of economic growth, if you miss a major change, you'll slide down to the green line. That if you cease to invest in the new economy, your economy will grow, but it won't grow as the rate as the other economies. You'll diverge away from it. And the blue line is where you can go in these major changes if you capture it and go ahead. And that's the essence of the Credit Suisse versus Boston prosperity or decline argument. Societies that can capture the new wave and do it properly will go up to the blue. Societies that fail will slide to the green. They don't become poor, but they decline with all the effects that take place in their society. And I think the new concepts of economic growth, in my view, not in the view of the program, say you've got to start paying more and more attention to this. One simplistic way then of thinking about it in a society like Canada is these rectangles describe where people work, approximately. About 25% work in what I will call the traded goods and services sector, that's the upper left-hand quadrant. About 25% work on the lower left-hand quadrant, dynamic services. Another 25% work in the upper right-hand quadrant, funded in our society by government, non-market then in that sense, consumption, and another 25% in the small retail, leisure, personal services sector market. Now, in an equilibrium economy, the outputs in all the quadrants are the same, but in an economic growth argument, there are engines that drive that system. And so the upper left-hand quadrant, from a Canadian perspective, the production of traded goods and services, is a driving force in terms of the basic wealth you're going to have to flow through the rest of the system. The dynamic services will not do well unless they do not have something to serve. If that left-hand side is working well, then the amount of money that comes in by taxation to governments will sustain universities and healthcare systems. But if it stumbles, you've got a problem. And of course, that feeds into the lower right-hand side of this whole dilemma. So that from this comes an issue of what really is primary wealth creation in a society as opposed to secondary functions. And you notice the arrows go in all directions because obviously having sophisticated infrastructures and education feeds back to the left-hand side. We don't think too much about how you create wealth. And the new concepts of economic growth say you have to. And the new understanding of deep and broad technological changes such as we're in now, in my judgment, say you really do have to pay attention to it if you want to get yourself out of the hole. I'll say a bit more about that. But what I do now like to look at is what happens to a country that fails. And the country that historically failed in this century to capture the technological waves of this century is the United Kingdom. And it's an interesting story because the financial institution in the lower left-hand box ceased to invest in that upper left-hand box, which are the instruments that drive the income flows in, and they proceeded to work with money in world financial markets, but not invest in the real economy. And when your financial institutions do that, your capital no longer drives that upper left-hand box that make the innovations that create your wealth flow. And it's interesting that the conservative member, I think it was a conservative government in 1904 in the United Kingdom, spoke to the banks about this problem, because he understood it. He said, you know, fellas, you should invest in the things which built our economy instead of your relaxed method of investing in financial matters, which really don't build the economy. Because if you don't do that, there will be decline in the overall wealth base of our country, which will affect you. He was right, but nobody paid any attention to him. And so, as a result, Britain has declined from being number one in world economies to 23rd throughout this century. And there's some interesting health effects that go with that. This is the standard mortality ratios in the United Kingdom, which come from their vital statistics, against their social classes from their census files. And to explain this slide, the higher the scale on the left, the higher the mortality rate. Scale on the bottom is years, and those things from 1 to 5 are social classes. And 5, it's at the top of the slide, of course, is the bottom of the social class heap. And 1 is at the top, it's at the bottom. And you'll notice that there's a gradient in health as measured by death this way across the social classes, which has widened dramatically since the introduction of public financing of healthcare. And indeed, people in the bottom tiers are not doing nearly as well by this simple way of displaying it. Everybody's health has improved, but the gradient in health has widened profoundly. The important part about this slide is that when Britain introduced public financing of healthcare in 1948, they assumed that medicine was a primary determinant of health. And they actually expect the gradient, which is modest back at that time, to become smaller. You can imagine how stunning this was to them when they did their Royal Commission, as all government-funded healthcare systems do, in the 1970s, and to find that the gradient had powerfully widened. And it's quite a marvelous Royal Commission report, because they're kind of stunned. Things have gone wrong, and they split into two camps. It's lack of access to healthcare. There are barriers. Doctors are bad personalities. They put people down, you know, all those bad things that doctors do. And the other side said, hell no, this is being driven, the underlying problems are social economic structures, which led to a very famous document called the Black Report, which the Labour government put in place, but Maggie Thatcher had come in power when the Black Report was tabled, and Maggie actually suppressed it. She only allowed 260 copies to be printed. But it was the most marvelous report on the real issue of how the social, environment, economic issues actually drive this. I happened to get wind of it, and the British High Commissioner was friendly and got me a copy, and I'm sure I broke all copyright laws because I still was at McMaster. I simply Xeroxed 30 copies and put them in the library for the medical nursing students to read. It was really quite a remarkable document. Now it is the Penguin. So that's the first marker in the UK. It's really rather interesting. The second marker is here. What you can do to get at the social economic factors, you can create what people call deprivation scores. You pool together unemployment rates, welfare rates, levels of education and income, et cetera. And you can go at these mortality rates by regions in the UK. And on the left-hand side on the horizontal scale are the least deprived people. And the most deprived people are on the right. And you'll note that these mortality figures show quite a good correlation between deprivation and having higher mortality rates. And you'll notice that the regions with the higher mortality rates are the regions of the original Industrial Revolution, Midland, Trent, Yorkshire, and they're not doing as well. The areas around London, where the financial institutions are that are in the money game, they're doing all right. And we do not have linear data that I've been able to find in the UK, but we do have comparison of Glasgow versus Edinburgh. The health status of Glasgow and Edinburgh were essentially identical 100 years ago.
Glasgow has deteriorated much more profoundly than Edinburgh, which is just a marker of this subset taking place within a society. So Britain is an example of an economy in trouble having effects on health. We now have a marvelous experiment from a health perspective going on. I shouldn't call it an experiment, but observation. We have the Eastern European story in which the life expectancy gap between Eastern and Western Europe has widened profoundly. It was widening, but in the last 6 years, it's widened very rapidly. And one of the world's experts on it is your own institution, Clyde Hertzmann. This shows you the changes in the crude death rates for Russia from 1980 to 1992. And you can see when they have this huge shift in their social economic structure created by their political revolution, people die. Pretty dramatic. It's caused pollution, etc., has been claimed, but the data from Poland is quite dramatic. And here what you have, and this has been done for all the Eastern European countries in one form or another, you have the death rates on the horizontal axis and age. And you notice in 1970, the single males, divorced males, sort of the orangey color, and the married males are about the same. The divorced ones aren't doing quite as well. But when you have a huge social economic change, the vulnerable groups get hit hardest. And single individuals are very seriously affected by that because they have less social support. And look at what's happened to the divorced males in 1988, whatever the date is on that slide, compared to those that have stayed married. And the importance of this slide is that it isn't pollution, it isn't lack of medical care, it's the underlying social change which is driving this huge change in the East-West life expectancy gap. So we have a very dramatic experiment taking place in Eastern Europe. Now, what are the pathways by which these processes affect health? I introduced you to the concept of gradients, and gradients are real, and now I'm going to take you through gradients in more detail. And the gradient says that if you take some marker like education, the people who are more highly educated will be healthier than the people who are poorly educated. And there'll be steps all the way down. And the basic gradients that people work with are work, income, social class, and education. But these are only associations, they're not causal. So let's look at them and see if we can open them up. Now people, all I say is that maybe the UK has a gradient, but maybe Canada doesn't have it. This is a neat piece of Canadian data done by Michael Wolfson in the program, which is simply taking the Canadian pension files and looking at the 500,000 males at that time who'd retired under the Canadian pension plan. We have their average earnings for the last 12 years of their working lives. That's plotted on the horizontal scale. And then we have their mortality rates after retirement. This is after retirement. And what you find is quite a good, clean, linear gradient. Not a surprising little threshold, just a good, clean, linear gradient. Higher average earnings, the longer you live after retirement. Now, what's not shown on this slide, but it goes back to the Poland slide, if you're a single male when you retire, your mortality rate at every one of those income quintiles is twice that of the males that stay spoused. The message I always give to males in the audience, in my generation, don't dump your spouse. You can't pick it up. You're better to stay there. We have no idea what happens to women in this data set. We only have those in the pension files. But that's quite a clear gradient. Now, the best gradient, and Bob, I'm sure, will say more about this next Saturday, are the human primates working in the center of London for the Government of England, the Whitehall Civil Service. They're a nice captive group of middle-class people. They're educated, well-housed, and well-fed. This is not a poverty question. I want to emphasize that too. This is you and I. And what you have is the cumulative deaths in the first 10 years of this study, and Michael Marmot, who runs the study, is part of the Institute's Pop Health Program, and you have the cumulative mortality on the vertical axis. And you'll notice that the administrators, the people at the very top, have fewer deaths than the people at the very bottom. Now these are all age and sex adjusted data. So you're comparing, in that sense, apples to apples to apples. The interesting thing is that the deans operating just below the presidents in a university hierarchy, but nobody's ever done this, Barry, on a university hierarchy. This is a civil service hierarchy. But the people just below the top bananas don't do as well. And the people just below them don't do as well. Now remember back to that thing I showed you about the data about mortality in the United Kingdom by social class being a gradient. Here's a gradient in social class 2 and 1, because that's essentially where these people are from, perhaps 3, 2, and 1, by death, which is quite dramatic. What on earth produces it? And the stunning thing about it, I don't want you to read this slide, just to show you the evidence is there. The gradient holds true for a variety of causes of death, lung cancer and other cancers, non-smoking related cancers, CHD is heart attacks, chronic bronchitis, gastrointestinal disease, genitourinary disease is interesting, it's a J-shaped curve, but the stunning thing is it includes accidents and suicides. When I first saw these data with my training, I was a bit stunned by them. I couldn't understand what the vapor was in Whitehall that would increase your risk of dying of a heart attack if you're in the lower tier, but also would increase the risk of you killing yourself in an accident or killing yourself by suicide. It's an interesting puzzle. And the thing that all this gradient data have shown us, when you now look at them by cause of death, is they're not disease specific. There are some diseases that do not show up in the gradient, but the major causes of adult death show up this way. Well, my pet subject is coronary heart disease. John mentioned that. Cholesterol and margarine, or sorry, butter and margarine. I'd have to change my stance now, John, if they talk to me. But this shows you if you're in the bottom tier of the Whitehall Civil Service and a male under the age of 55, that's the right-hand side, your risk of dying of a heart attack is 4 times that of a person in the top tier. The stunning thing that this kind of population perspective on health shows is that medical risk factors don't turn out to be that powerful. You notice that cholesterol is that orangish-yellow color, and what they did is they tested these observations for how much of this risk was due to cholesterol. It's zero. Smoking has a very small effect, and blood pressure a small effect. The bulk of that gradient is not explainable by any standard medical risk factor, is something to do with the civil service hierarchy. That's important. How in the hell do you explain it? Well, this is the beginning of the explanation, and this has been replicated in the civil service. This is the risk of having coronary heart disease symptoms in 1,600 members of the Swedish labor force classified by the demands of the job, which is that sort of semi-vertical axis, and by the control, the semi-horizontal axis. And 20% of this labor force in high-demand jobs with poor control have coronary heart disease symptoms. These are all, again, age standardized and sex standardized data. The top civil servants, let us say, in the high-demand, high-control, less than 3%, and university professors, low demand, high control, nobody has symptoms. I'm not sure who exactly that population group is. But that data starts to tell you something. It comes back to that loop I was talking to you about at the beginning about the brain dynamics with the rest of the body. So in coming to this puzzle and talking to one of, I guess I'd have to say, the more imaginative public health people in the United States, Leonard Syme, who actually trained Michael Marmot, when I went to see him many years ago about this subject, and he thought I was a cholesterol freak, I'm glad you didn't show him that black and white thing. And he really looked down at me when I came into his office to talk about this subject. I said, Len, I don't understand why there should be these gradients that are not disease specific. What's the explanation? He said, Mustard, it's coping skills. I say, what do you mean by coping skills, Len? Well, that gets back into that little slide, so I'm now going to take you into coping skills as I've begun to learn it. And the story here comes back into what I said earlier on. It's clear that the stimulation that the cortex of the brain receives, those billions of neurons, in early life when they're undifferentiated and have to differentiate, powerfully influences their structure and function. And if you want to hear about that, invite Max Sinner to talk to you about it if you've not had him speak to you, because he's probably one of the best authorities in North America on the subject. And the second linkage is the thing Selye talked about, but has now become a lot clearer. that the cortex of the brain ties into the rest of the body's systems. Indeed, McLean had an issue largely on this subject earlier this year. And it affects the immune systems, it affects the host defense pathways in a broad sense, and it comes back to my professor of pathology story. You can have the TB bacillus, but if your host defense system's pretty good, you won't come down with disease expression. But if you knock your host defense system down, watch out, you'll get into trouble. And how well you live in your environment obviously affects the dynamics of these systems. Now, this is pretty hard data on the eye. And as I said, you've got an authority in your own city you can talk to about it. But when an animal is born, the cortex, the upper blue area, is not differentiated. And so you see the pathways from the eyes, the lower part, coming into an undifferentiated cortex. So the brain really doesn't see what the eye sees. But those signals coming in from the eye turn on the genetic machinery in those cortical cells in that part of the brain to differentiate for vision purposes. And so the cells now differentiate and develop their specific functions. But the stimuli that keep coming in keep molding the function of these neurons to get their full function. So we now know that the quality of the sensory inputs hitting the cortex of the brain when it's most plastic, which is later in utero in the first 3 years of life, are basically going to govern how the cortical functions develop. And that's true, my colleagues tell me, for the sensing systems, and cognition and behavior are not unraveled yet, but they tell me that by the end of this decade, probably be really well unraveled, and probably the same control pathways are in place. So this now means that 0 to 3 story is not trivial, if that's basically setting competence and coping skills. And this is just the biological pathway, and the steroids sit there in fairly bold letters. Now that seems to be one of the principal culprits. People are following this kind of tracking can show that under stressful circumstances of somebody snarling at you and not coping well, your steroid levels rise, and how quickly you come back to equilibrium is an extremely important part of this dynamic. I won't take you through the rest of that in any detail. But this is a summary of the neuroscience story, actually in a 1994 document put up by the Carnegie Corporation in the United States, which is led by David Hamburg, who's championed children for a long time. He originally was a psychiatrist. And it contains 5 bullets, which summarize this. Very hard data now, in my judgment. The brain development before age 1 is more rapid and extensive than previously realized. So children in that early period need good environments of stimulation as well as nourishment. Brain development is more vulnerable to environmental influences than suspected. Kids put in deprived, stimulating, nurturing environments will pay a price. The effects of early environment are long-lasting. Now that's a hook, because it also means that if you are adversely handled during this period, you may not be able to correct things later on. In other words, you end up by implanting defects that cannot be turned around. The environment affects the number of brain cells and the way they're wired. And the final one is the one that's a bit frightening, and that is too high steroid levels, even in young children, can kill off neurons in the hippocampus permanently. In other words, you can cause permanent loss. It also has implications for steroids in my generation of age group, because it may have effects on cortical function as well. So we're now beginning to explore and understand all of this. Can we apply any of it? Well, it's hard to do long-term studies in our species, because nobody can live long enough to do a full observational study. Most universities would fire you if you tried to do a 10 to 15 to 20 year project, which you couldn't put a paper up for 20 years. So there's a huge negative effect of the environments for doing research and getting at this. But if you take a non-human primate species that cycles every 6 years, you can actually get a view of this. And these are rhesus macaque monkeys, and I've done a summary of Steve Sumi's work, who's actually in our human development program. These primates have been genetically defined as susceptible and resistant. The susceptible strain, when they're challenged, have a huge outpouring of these chemicals. The resistant strain don't have the same outpouring. It doesn't mean they don't have effects, they obviously do, but they can't pick those up the same way as in the susceptible strain. If the susceptible strain of these animals, when they're very young, are poorly parented, that's the negative, they don't do well. They can't cope in adult life. As young children, they're withdrawn, they have behavioral problems, etc. And because these are matriarchal troops, rhesus macaques, when they're shoved out, the males, they essentially get killed. They can't loop back into new troops. Whereas those that are well-nurtured, good positive parenting in the susceptible strain, cope extremely well and actually come back and become the leaders. It's a marvelous story of the nature-nurture argument, clearly demonstrated in a species where everything is fairly definable. The distinctive characteristic is that the ones that are well-parented or well-nurtured, when they're challenged, have the huge outpouring, but they come back to the resting levels very quickly. And it looks like this coping story is how well you come back to equilibrium. That's the real trick. And so if you cope well with the challenge, you'll come back. And if you don't, those levels stay up, but suppress a whole series of other body functions which have the negative effects we saw in the susceptibility to health problems and behavioral problems. Now, in terms of humans, we don't have much good experimental data. This is a small randomized trial, which people criticize, but it's an interesting study against which I've shown you. What they did is they took a group of kids in a poor community in Michigan, Ypsilanti, and randomized them into an intervention group and a non-intervention group between the ages of 3 and 6, and gave these kids in groups of 5 what I would call a substitute parenting world. I'm sure somebody called it learning, but they build up an interaction dynamic with these children, with them, with whatever parents were available. It did not change IQ in the intervention group, but the man who's been running the study has kept following these children who are now adults, and this is the age 18 to 20 story. In the intervention group, the employment was twice as good at this stage. High school completion, 1/3 higher. Teenage pregnancies, 40% less. Drug use, substantially less. They've now tracked them through to the late 20s. The mental health problems are 1/5 those in the non-intervention group. And so, you know, it kind of fits. That early period is pretty crucial, and this is the first data that I know of longitudinally along that's sort of coherently with that. And indeed, the economic estimate is that for every dollar invented in the 3 to 6 period, the return to the U.S. economy in terms of people working, people not being in crime, people not being depressed, and mental health has been $7. So it's a pretty substantial story. We have no evidence about very early childhood, other than this Jamaican study and one from Mexico that I'm aware of. And this is a very important study because most people now who work in this field believe that if the Ypsilanti intervention had been done at birth, the outcome would be even better. And this simply shows you a group of high-risk kids at birth, the bottom cluster of 4 lines, measuring their development over a 2-year period in which the control is given nothing. They're not helped in any way. And this is a situation where nourishment is also an issue. One group were given food supplements, that's yellow. One group is given stimulation or nurturing, however you want to use that language, and the green are given both. And you'll notice that when the kids get both, by the age of 2, they reach the same level of development as the control group. And you'll also notice that stimulation or nurturing are as powerful as foodstuffs. Now, as I said, Fogel, in doing his analysis, couldn't pick up that question. So that's quite a dramatic effect. And I think most people feel that if we could ever do a proper longitudinal study on our own populations where we have problems, that you'd get these effects very powerfully. How does this translate into academic performance? Robbie Case, who's in the Human Development Program, sits as part of these international comparison studies on school achievement. And this is the grade 8 math achievement story, and what they're doing is the data were not collected for doing this, but when Case came into our program and realized the gradient story in health being driven by what it was, he said, hell, school performance has to be driven the same way. So he started to try to look at the data from that perspective, and all they have is occupational status of the father, which is the weak social economic marker. But given that, look at the United States gradient. If you were concerned about the quality of your population for the future, that should trouble you. It's really quite dramatic. The ones at the top are Japan. As far as one can tell, it's almost a flat line. They can't fill in the gap, but it probably doesn't sag. And Canada, this time this was done, this is the mid-1980s, is not doing badly. Interesting. So we know it feeds through into school system performance. And this is the weakest data about health. But it's not bad. This is from Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom, where the records allow this to be done. What they're doing is taking people who die of heart attacks, but 80% of the population who was born there in 1910 still lives there. So they can go back into their records at the age of one, which are available in their system, and they can only use weight, they can't get at height, but not sure height means that much at one anyway, but anyhow, if you look at weight as a rough proxy for development, you notice that your risk of dying of a heart attack, if you're at the good weight end, at the bottom, is one-third of that of the person who is not there. So we're beginning to find in the tracking that as you look at these chronic disease story in adult life, the time back into early childhood and the coping skills story, which I was talking about, is real. How it works this way for coronary heart disease, if you don't cope well and you keep those hormone levels up, you probably set up processes that damage the lining of your major arteries, which is the process by which you cause atherosclerosis and thrombosis. We'd be glad to take anybody on later on if they want to talk about that, but I just thought I should tie this in for you. Now, if you're still with me, we'll wind up with going into the economic argument. It's getting late. Let's look at where we stand in this revolution. We're in a deep technological revolution, chips for neurons, and what can we do about it? What's taking place? Well, first thing is that if you look at Western countries, as Dahrendorf was doing, Canada is not unique. These are the European, Western European countries, and you'll see in 1974, debt starts to rise and unemployment starts to rise, characteristic of a profound change. Total factor productivity is interesting in this period. You notice that Canada has been virtually dead on the water from 1974 to 1990. The United States isn't doing very well. And characteristic of an economy in deep change and not coping well. This is our public spending. This is actually done by the Morgan Stanley Bank, of all people, but it shows government spending as a percentage of the GDP from 1960 to 1994. And Canada's that sort of middle whitish-gray line. And you'll notice that we're not the biggest spender amongst these OECD countries. That's important for you to realize. We're not, by the way GDP is calculated, the biggest spenders. But lo and behold, this is from 1980 to 1994, during this period against these other OECD countries, we managed to accumulate the biggest public debt. Well, if you're not the biggest public spender, how do you create the biggest public debt? Well, the simple answer is that GDP can be driven by borrowing money to spend it, and so GDP masks your borrowing phenomenon. And if your wealth base isn't really increasing, what you do is you have to end up with a debt. And this is our other debt, which is the cumulative external debt of the country, showing that it has climbed substantially since 1975. It's called the current account deficit in standard jargon, but you'll notice how it's climbed rather steadily since 75. And that's the foreign debt of our country. That is the people outside giving us money to carry our debt, but this is private and public sector. It's not just government, it's a mixture. And if you express this as foreign indebtedness instead of cumulative current account debt, you see that Canada is very distinguished amongst these countries. Even Italy doesn't have as high a cumulative external debt as we have. Ours is massive. And so basically our wealth base, by my criteria, has been declining because we have not been able to move into the new economy. So that means you have spillover effects. If that upper left-hand quadrant isn't working well, then you don't have the income to sustain flows to sustain the rest of your system. So governments have to cut back the scale that they're doing it, and other people have to cut back, and you're seeing all of that taking place in your society, but you have huge income skews which develop in your society, which will affect children. And so this shows you, for Canada, the change in average income from 1981 to 1991, and you'll see us old fat cats are doing pretty well. But any of you under 40 aren't doing as well. And if there are people under 40 or under 30 who are angry about my generation, they deserve to be angry. But you look at that age group, that's the age group that has the rear children. And what you notice here in this slide is this is from Stats Canada, percentage of children and seniors in families with low income, and you notice that the seniors have been coming down from percentage. We've done a good job in getting my generation protected, but you'll notice the creeping rise in children getting into trouble. Slowly, the taking place. That's a real problem that comes with deep and profound technological, economic, and social change. Interesting, we hear all sorts of debates about the transfer payments. For the people in the bottom 50% of the incomes in Canada, the percentage of their income from earnings in 1970 was over 60%. In 1990, the percentage of their earnings from work is less than 30%, or is getting down to 30%, and their incomes are being held up by transfer payments. As the governments have to cut back on transfer payments, what happens to these people and their family structures? We know a little bit from this, from Quebec data. And what you have is a group of regions in Quebec. Ottawa and Quebec on this slide are prosperous and not too much trouble. The areas at the bottom of Montreal, and particularly the core inner area of Montreal, are real problem areas. And the bluish-green bars tell you the number of children coming to kindergarten who can't cope and adopt antisocial behavior. That figure in CECM is over 21%. It's now, I think, up to 27%. That may not trouble you, but it should, because these kids have been damaged before they hit the school system. And this is the dropout rate for these kids in the Montreal system. The ones that fight all the time are out by the age of 14. And they've tried intervention programs in the school system to turn this around. You can have some effect, but it's very difficult to turn around problems that are set before kids hit school. Problems that emerge in the later periods are more easily turned around because of that neuroscience story. Ever since I gave you that little story about being on the front page of the Globe and Mail, I've been to school boards in every province in this country virtually. And no high school principals, public school principals, will tell you over 30% of the male children in some schools coming in cannot cope and are a serious problem. And the nice news, I guess if you're in the police force, is that the Montreal database, the antisocial group at the top, these are the males hitting who can't cope, and these are when they hit kindergarten, by the age of 13, 28% are delinquent. So if you're in the juvenile justice world, you need to work with the preschool people trying to get at this problem. So, the stability and quality of a society is, as I've tried to tell you, heavily influenced by its pool of human ingenuity. That's sort of the argument that came from Fogel. The institutions which these people can work in can create the resources needed by a society, but in the social economic system influences the distribution of those resources. We're in a period where we've got a breakdown in this equation, and that can lead to deterioration in your society, because if you shift more and more people out of the competence and ability to cope in your society, they become a second tier, as is present in the United States, and you two-tier your society. You basically cannot sustain a democratic society if you make that too big an issue. So it's really quite a challenge to try to cope with this and prevent that problem from occurring. And it's interesting that Freeman and Perez writing about this, many intricate social and institutional adjustments, the redirection of financial investments, planning is usually entailed in the effective passage from one technological regime to another. Now I'm going to give you a clue as to what you and I could do to let us succeed. And the first one is, remember what Joseph Chamberlain wrote in 1904, let's talk to our banks and say, how do you invest in the risks and uncertainties of the new economy rather than investing in objects or the playing with money? That's a very fundamental question to ask. How do our pension funds learn to invest in the new economy at levels which are necessary to build that new economy? Let's not fall into the British trap. We're there, but let's not stay there. Now, this is a little bit of a complicated slide, but it's important. That second bar down from the top, total production, is your wealth production. Your expenditure is your consumption plus your investment, the third line down. Now, don't think these are scaled the right way. The consumption box is much bigger than the investment box. Just the boxes had to be scaled that way because of lettering. But if your investment isn't into the new economy, which is the bottom line, you're in deep trouble. And that bottom line describes what my friend Barry McBride has been arguing for years and others. Investing in the development and flow of ideas is crucial for building a new economy. Ask yourself, how successful are we in investing in the uncertainties and risks which drive those interfaces in that lower box? Ask yourself what public policies we have to make that work. What incentives do we have? What tax incentives do we have to really make that work? Because if you don't make that work, you can't build a new economy. So all of us in the room can influence our country's policies that influence investment. Some of us have access to pools of money which can drive investment. But if you don't do it, you will slide into the British problem, and perhaps more seriously than the British. How do you maintain stable social environments? No one knows. Putman, in his book, Making Democracy Work, talks about Northern versus Southern Italy, and he talks about civic societies and social capital. I think there's some merit in this. In talking to communities across Canada, they're responsive to it. If communities understand the diagnosis and the nature of the problem, it's surprising how they can come together to create horizontal instruments that allow for interaction and to maintain some sense of social commitment to stabilizing your society. And let me give you one example. We got called by principal of a public school in North Bay 2 years ago or 2.5 years ago to say, I've got the problem. We said, what problem? He said, 30% of the male kids coming into my public school can't cope. I said, look, North Bay is a small community. You shouldn't have that problem. He said, we have it. We have other schools that don't have it. I said, tell me about the social environment in which these kids are being brought up in. It is a social environment hit by the economic stresses, closed military bases, divorced families, etc. I said, boy, you understand it in spades. You don't need us. He said, yes, I do. I want you to come up and meet with our community to tell them what I'm telling you tonight, which they did, so that they can understand it, so they'll come with us and help solve the problem. And I'll tell you that they're doing it. It's really quite remarkable to watch what this principal, his director of education, have been to mobilize people who spend money on the symptoms rather than spending it on the interventions beforehand that prevent the symptoms from appearing in young children. So that's a pretty good news story, and there are other communities in Canada I could identify. So maybe Putman's right. But you have to transfer the understanding to people so they can make use of it. So there's one thing in this change. Make sure your children have a first priority. The debate about daycare and the crap that came out, if I may use the language, last week. I mean, you just wonder what goes on in people's minds. Maybe they had a bad early childhood, I don't know. So my conclusion is, we are in a period of deep and profound change in which prosperity or decline is the right question to pose. Can we make use of the knowledge we have about the determinants of health, economic growth, and human development to handle this change better than any previous generation? The answer is we should be able to. And my plea to Canadians is that the one thing as a nation we have the capacity to do better than the Americans is to do this. And so my conclusion is I think we'll head to prosperity as long as enough of us understand the challenge and are prepared to make the commitment to solve the problem. So I'm not sure I had a good early childhood, but it was fun talking to you tonight. And that concludes the sermon. John says you can ask questions or throw darts. Yes?
In the 1950s, it was the common idea in every business and in the stock market that you invest in research, you invest in the companies that make research. That idea disappeared by 1970. My question is, would that have happened anyhow without the Harvard Business School?
The question is a solid one. After the Second World War, United States culture seemed to understand the importance of science and technology innovation for economic growth, and it changed in the 1970s. And the question is, what are the forces that drove that? I wouldn't put the Harvard Business School as the only source that drove that. Remember, the concepts of the determinants of economic growth that I described tonight had not embedded itself in the way Paul Romer has put it in to the philosophy today. And so it was easy to think of the outputs in all of those quadrants as being equal. Remember that two rectangles I saw? And so if you're in a financial institution, making money by playing with money, if I can use that language, is just as legitimate, and you get the money quicker than if you take these high-risk uncertainty investments. And I think it's the fact that we became dominated by an interpretation of Adam Smith, which was a misinterpretation of Adam Smith, and not really understanding the driving force behind Solow's argument. Yeah, economic growth is there and the forces that drive it, but the basic driving force, the stuff he couldn't identify, was the really thing you had to pay attention to, and those loops never came together. And so what happens in this game, of course, then is political processes become captured by certain groups, and there's pretty good evidence now that the United States is largely captured by the crew that like to play with money, which will then steer your political force on you. So I wouldn't blame the Harvard Business School as being the sole factor. Yes? If I may rephrase the question is how much indigenous ownership do you have to drive the building of a new economy? That's my interpretation of the economic growth story, is that you have to have a certain indigenous capacity. And let me try to articulate that. You have on the North Shore of Vancouver an outfit called Ballard Power, which in my judgment has the leading fuel cell technology in the world. That technology will be an important power source for the future. And it doesn't take any genius to realize how far that will go where they've got the technology developed too. If they were part of Mitsubishi or Daimler-Benz, you don't have to worry. It would be developed and be a powerful part of that region and go to the rest of the world. They're not. They are a Canadian company working on their own wits without the capital base behind them, without financial institutions that are with them that would share the risk of getting to where they have to go. So we're extremely vulnerable. And if you just take that story further, you got the Liberal Party coming here tomorrow night, is it? Why in the hell don't you go down and greet them and say, why didn't you give a contract to Winnipeg's transit company to buy 12 hydrogen-powered buses, put in service in Winnipeg, which lets Ballard Power grow, lets Flyer Bus grow, which is also a U.S. company, and you can build the capacity and the hydrogen technology to drive the damn things. And so what do is you get three buses going to Chicago, which is fine, but you should drive your own economy. So in a sense, the nature of these deep and broad technological changes mean you do have to raise the question which you asked. My view is you've asked the right question. Others would disagree with me. But unless you've got pools of capital investing in things that create wealth for your region, the chances of the remaining committed to your region are not high. And you go and try and talk to the Germans or the Swiss about this and talk to their leading industrialists. They understand this in spades and have the commitment to their region as multinational companies. Yes?
Fraser, you suggested that if we eliminated poverty, we'd have a healthier population. If we eliminated unemployment and the murderous effects of unemployment, we'd have a healthier population. I don't see that happening. We're moving in the opposite direction. The mortality rate is going up. It doesn't seem like it's a problem of technology. In fact, technology could be part of the problem. I'm personally very pessimistic, and writers like Dalton Kent, for instance, have suggested that it's a question of dysfunctional, laissez-faire economics,
Well, the question is a highly relevant one. There are a lot of negative features you can pick up in society: unemployment rates, infant mortality rate changes, the things I showed you about children, etc. And of course, your concluding comment is rather nice: laissez-faire economics. Now, this language means different things to different people. But I think the biological history of the human primate is that if you really believe in chaotic individualism, you're basically going to destroy the species that believe in that. You mean you can't sustain yourself for the future. Now, it won't affect you probably, or me. But if you're interpreting a free market economics as chaotic individualism, that may be all right for a decade or so, but you know that the next generation is going to pay a very high price. And if you do produce the next generation, and some of them grow up in good environments, they'll know that they'll take the hideout on the people who created the mess. If you look at Asian cultures at the moment, and the Confucius background, some of them seem to be practicing capitalism, not in socialism, but capitalism in a societal context. For example, Toyota, so far, has been able to avoid dumping off huge numbers of its workers when it has to adjust, but its pools of money that it has are in the billions. It's cash it controls. And so it, in effect, gives its own unemployment insurance for its labor force while it adjusts to changes. Our companies can't do that because of the way we structured them, the stock structures, etc. Now, remember my friend Dan Keating's phrase, experiments with civilization. My view is if you understand that phrase and understand that each of these major technological changes produce huge effects and huge opportunities, which you can bomb, once you understand that and can make the adjustments, I'm optimistic. But I think you're dead on. If you cannot get your systems and people to understand it, then you do run the risk of going the other way. And that, of course, that's Dahrendorf's argument about the fate facing Western countries at the moment. He doesn't see any sign that the Western countries are coping with this change adequately. Yes?
What advice would you have for the Federal Minister of Finance?
I would say to the Minister of Finance, let us bring three ministries together. Those that are concerned with the quality of the population, particularly through children, that's number one I'd bring into my portfolio. Two, I'd want to bring in that ministry that's concerned, along with me, about the real issues that determine economic growth. And if we're going to sit down and construct a coherent way to create incentives and infrastructure to build a new economy, at the same time invest what limited resources we have in the key areas to maintain stable social environments. As long as they leave them separate, running separate paths, it will just go down the road to disaster. And there's one province in this country that the senior bureaucrats are trying to do that, and that's Manitoba, which is interesting. I mean, they understand the reason for linkage. So that'd be my advice to Paul, and if you can capture him, tell him. Yes? The question is, how do you provide good parenting? Let me say, to begin with, you must think in this rapidly changing world. In most Western countries, over 30% of the children are now in single-parent female-led families. And that's not just because women become pregnant and have a child. This is a real phenomenon that's taking place. Secondly, you have a huge proportion of your younger generation, two parents working, having to buy substitute parenting services during the day, which is also an important message. Now, I don't think there are any of them in the audience, but they live in your community. You have a very strong Ismaili community in Vancouver. They can answer your question better than I can, but I'm going to tell you why they can make that answer. They have survived for hundreds of years living in very diverse parts of the world, East Africa, parts of Asia, under tough circumstances in which they're a very minority group. But they run three councils, one in economics, one in education stroke development, and one in health. And they have a huge principle about early childhood. They actually run daycare services for their communities, but they let anybody else come into it. And last Monday night, Dorothy and I went to a celebration of 20 years of one of the, they call them children's learning centers, which they have set up in Toronto. They now have 6 of them. This couple came from Uganda with no money in 1974, as many Ismailis did. They had to struggle to stay alive, and they had to put the children into a daycare center. And they put the children in the daycare center, and they said, this is a babysitting service. It's not a child care center. So they set out to do it, create their own centers for mothers to put children in from a very early age, totally cognizant with what I've been talking to you about tonight. And they, in that center, provide the support to the whatever parents are present of the child during the daytime. They provide support in educating the parents about what should be done, etc., and let them cope. And they've been enormously successful. One of their units is in the worst area of Toronto, Jane Finch, and it's extraordinarily successful in what it does. Embodied in that is a broader thing than just parenting. It's social responsibility to do this, which I think is absolutely fundamental, which then will help reinforce the answer to the question which you posed. But unless you do it that way, the burden will become huge. The other thing you should know about the rhesus macaque monkey study, rhesus macaques born to a female who's been poorly nurtured in the high-risk group, she will poorly nurture her offspring. But if you put a non-biological parent in at birth, the outcome's fine. And so that brings that daycare debate into a very important sort of aspect as you start to look at that. All right. Way up there at the back, your hand up. Your question is an extremely important one. The data systems that I'm familiar with can't help us answer that question yet, but if you think about it, the women in my generation live in strongly, very high quality support networks, which they build, whether husbands at work and various other things that take place. And so we know that the support structure, remember that story of what happened to the divorced men in Poland? The effect on divorced women is much less, which is interesting in terms of the phenomenon that's taking place there. Now, how much of it's tied to the actual support structures around you as an adult, which we know are extremely important, and how much it's rooted to the early period in life, we just don't know at the moment. Clyde Hertzman is working with Chris Power in the UK on what they call the 1958 British birth cohort, which is 16,000 births in 1958, which they've now tracked into the 30s. And you should talk to him and ask him, because they could probably start to answer your question. Yes. Well, the Royal Bank is helping support this evening, and Mr. I should tell you that Mr. Taylor, when he was head of the Royal Bank, had this sermon for me, because they're one of our biggest supporters, and he shouted down whatever bank president shouted down to his troops, learn how to finance innovation, and the Royal Bank has started to take steps in that direction. So that says, having done that, and we have spoken to all the Royal Bank people out here a year and a half ago about these themes. And when I were talking to the CIBC 2 years ago, one of the senior vice presidents said, how do you stop us playing fiscal roulette? And she wasn't doing that because she thought it was wrong. She was caught in a structure of incentives that they were driven to do it, but she knew it was the wrong way to be putting their money. So you have to start to ask the question and then think about what you can do about it. And that, when you're talking to Mr. Martin, you ask him, why should the tax structure for a Ballard Power be the same as the tax structure for Otto Forgath when he plays with money? You know, you ask simple questions like that, and you start to get answers which will change some of the incentives. It's not entirely the bank's fault, is my point. It's the fault of the rest of us not coming to grips with it.
We should stop, John.
I'd like to ask one more time, is Mr. Brad Lambert here? Just so that you know, the reason I'm asking that is he's a representative of the Royal Bank, who was going to be thanking the speaker. In his absence, I can't think of anybody better to thank the speaker than the president of Simon Fraser University, Dr. John Stubbs, who is probably thinking now about how long his years are going to be after retirement. John. I mean, of course, in the context of Fraser's remarks earlier about longevity.
The mic's off.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, John. And I am very pleased to be invited at short notice to thank tonight's speaker. I've admired Fraser Mustard from a distance for a long time, and one of the great delights of coming to British Columbia and becoming president of Simon Fraser was that I could have some peripheral involvement in the Canadian Institute of Advanced Research, because as you've heard, some members of our faculty are quite active in the programs of the Institute. I've known Fraser Mustard, as I'm sure many others have, from a distance for a long time, and I'm always overwhelmed by a number of qualities that were very much in evidence tonight. One is energy, another one is the ability to communicate, a third one is someone who is a polymath, who can move very, very comfortably among a large number of disciplines, a person who I know